Hi, everybody. I'm Susie Donahue. I'm an alcoholic and very short. Kind of scary. It's like it's going to get me. I know, who knew? Surprising. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Never dreamed about it. Never planned it. Kind of like Wallace. But first, I want to say thank you very much, Billy and Sam and Lynn and everybody that invited me. It's more than just a privilege. It's an honor to be here. To be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really don't deserve to even have a chair. The kind of life that I lived prior to September 29th, 1987, that was my story. And the story I'm going to tell you that happened after September 29th, 1987 is God's story. So for just a moment, I want to just thank him. You know, I'm one of those kids that came from part of the CIA, Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. And I'm a kid that's a product of an alcoholic family, and there's nothing wrong with that. They're very fine people. As a matter of fact, I'm not a bad girl myself. And I was raised in Seattle, Washington. My father was a dentist and a doctor. My mom was a psychiatrist, and I was one of those kids that had a working mother, which was very odd back then. I'm kind of aging myself, but I had a normal childhood, I thought. Alcohol was kind of like toothpaste at my house. It was everywhere. It was fancy clinking glasses, beautiful beaded gowns, a lot of tails and tuxes and parties. And to me, it seemed so incredibly wonderful. It just seemed like the highlight. And for me, I just wanted to be a part of that early on. At 6 years old, I used to clean up the tables after my parents' parties, and I would grab the glasses and drink the warmth of the brown amber liquid going down my throat, and I can remember comfort. But late at night, you know, after some of the parties started really getting to go, there were terrible things that happened in my home. There were doors slamming and name-calling and a lot of hitting and slapping. And car accidents, and people leaving, and children crying. And I didn't ever heed that warning about alcohol. I didn't realize that that was all a result of alcoholic drinking. You know, and when I was a young kid, we used to get little glasses of wine at dinner at our grandparents' house. But my first real drink that I took purposefully, I was 12 years old. I had older brothers, and they really had some cute friends, I'll tell you. I was so excited. And two of the boys asked me to go up to the local school and drink some Mickey Widemouth beers with them. And, of course, I didn't want to even ask what that was because I wanted them to think I knew. And so I drank a couple of those, and it must have been, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and I woke up at 9 o'clock at night in the woods by myself. And that was my first drink. I don't remember vomiting. But I remember coming to and wondering how I got in the field. And I just went home, and I couldn't wait to do it again. You know, if I had been a, quote, a normal child, I might have been slightly scared by that. I might have thought, gee, not a good idea. Probably, you know, normal people probably wouldn't do that again. But that wasn't my experience. I couldn't wait to do it again. And something happened to me, and before I blacked out, I suddenly realized that I didn't care that other people used to think I was fat and chubby. I didn't care that those boys were so cute and that they didn't want me. I didn't care what happened. I liked the effect produced by that alcohol. I didn't get 6 feet tall. I'd wish. I stayed 5'1". But something inside here changed. When that spirit, those spirits entered me, there was some kind of transformation that occurred in me. And there was that sense of ease and comfort that they talk about in the doctor's opinion. And I knew, truly, that I wasn't alone. And that's what I had been looking for all my life. As a young girl, like I said, we were Catholic, and we were the Sunday Catholics. You know, we went to church on Sunday, and we prayed at meals when my grandparents were there. And that was really my experience with God. That was all I really ever knew about God. I knew there was a Bible, the family Bible, and it had some important documents in it, but I'd never read it or never looked at it. And I went to CCD because there were a lot of cute boys at CCD. And that seemed to be a real focal point for me early on. So, you know, that was my first higher power, I think, was a boy. And obviously at 12, drinking with, you know, 15-year-old boys, that was my higher power. But I just lived that kind of life where we just, religion was a separate entity, and God went with that religion. But I never knew a God of my understanding. I never had a relationship with God. I had depended all my life on humans. And, you know, that was what I thought of. I tried to trust my parents. I tried to trust men. And I never had anything that would not let me down. And early in my drinking career, by the time I was about 13 or 14, you know, when I drank, I could never guarantee what was about to happen. There would be times when I imagine it was fun, where I was the life of the party, or at least I'd hope so. And, you know, oftentimes I'd worry that I still wasn't enough. I mean, alcohol didn't do everything for me. It wasn't magic. But, you know, I still had those doubts about myself. And I wondered, you know, often if there was a way that I could stop the pain, because pain was starting to enter my life, and I wanted to blame it on my childhood. You know, my parents drank heavily, and I was 13 years old, and I was at a football game, and the sheriff and the family priest showed up, and they called my name down from the stadium, and I went down to the office, and they told me that my father had drove off a cliff drunk, and I was left with my mother. And my mom was the kind of drinker that, you know, she eventually, I drank just like her, where you couldn't tell 2 in the afternoon or 10 at night, I could be incapacitated. So I was really mad at God, that same old God. Now he'd taken my father from me, and now I was totally alone. And at that moment, I went about 3 degrees away from God, and that's all it took, was to turn my back. And a year later, I got a bed sheet out the closet, and I tied it as tight as I could around my neck, and I threw it over the curtain rod, and I jumped from my bed. Obviously, you know, it didn't work well. And with all my heart, I just wanted to be with my dad. I just wanted to die. You know, I was always, as a child, a very neurotic kid. In the big book, they talk about having a spiritual maladjustment. I was ill way before I ever drank. I didn't react to situations normally. As a matter of fact, I really didn't know what normally meant. But I was hyper nervous, worried frequently, living in fear most of the time, afraid of everything. And I thought that suicide would be the answer. And when it wasn't, I ran away. And I had a small younger brother at home. My other older brothers had already moved out of the house after my father died. And so I was 14 years old, and I put some clothes in a backpack. And that was the last day that I stayed in my mother's home ever. And I walked out into the street, and I began to live anywhere that I could at 14. And I didn't have very much experience with life at that point. I'd been in a very sheltered environment, and suddenly I was just having to live in parked cars. Sometimes I could stay with people. Some of my friends from, you know, high school, I would stay overnight or in the backyard on a porch swing, or I'd stay in their parents' car until they woke me up in the morning. They'd wonder why I was sleeping in their car, and I'd make up some story how I couldn't go home. And I lived in the streets eventually as I was drinking more and more. You know, people don't want a drunk teenager at their house. It was a lot of responsibility. And after a while, people didn't want to hear my sad story. Because, see, I was a victim, that poor, terrible family I came from. You know, it was all their fault I was drinking like this. And that really was so untrue, but it worked so well. And I began to tell that story everywhere it went. And people, out of the kindness of their heart, they started to feed me and give me places to stay. But sometimes when you're 15 years old and you're not really supposed to be working in the back of a restaurant, you have to do the things that a 15-year-old girl should never do. You have to see the things that a 15-year-old kid should never have to see. And as I began to do that, I began to drink more and more, because it was harder and harder to wake up in the morning after a night like the night before. My life consisted of trying to go to high school, working in a restaurant, and I would stay at a rooming house often when I'd have enough money, and I'd put all the furniture up against the door because I'd be so afraid somebody was going to come in the room at night. And I would sit there and drink by myself. But I always managed to go to school, so I guess I was a functioning alcoholic from the time I was very young. As if that was going to make it any different. What I loved about that life was there was a sense of excitement. And I really believe that part of my illness is that excitement. I like to live on the edge. And by the time I was 16 years old, I was a blackout drinker. It was a guarantee at that point. When I drank, bad things happened. It was, you know, there was no counting on a couple of good nights anymore. This morning, Tom came over and knocked on my door to let us know we were coming up here. And I had one shoe on, one shoe off. And it all of a sudden, it triggered a memory. I used to lose my shoes all the time when I was drinking. And I think it was because I threw up on them. So I just left them wherever I was. But it reminds me that that was the kind of life I lived. 16, 17, 18 years old. You know, I was a blackout drinker. And, you know, for me, God bless Wallace, I couldn't drink anything like old granddad. If I did that, you know, the clothes come off, I'm swinging T-shirts in the air, I'm waking up with $300 in my pocket, you know. And, you know, that's just not a pretty thing at 17. You know, it's just not a good thing. But I managed to graduate from high school because the high school had never seen my mother's signature. They'd only seen mine. And I graduated with honors from high school. And I thought, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go to college. And I applied for a scholarship. And I got into University of Arizona with a full-paid scholarship. And I thought, I'll be an English teacher and I'll have a wife. And this crazy, crazy street living will end. And I went away to school. And I found a place called the Green Dolphin right next to school. It was a beautiful place. It was lowly lit. Tavern with all kinds of pool tables and men. I mean, real men. I loved it. It was great. I could beat them all at pool, and I made all kinds of money at night. And I drank like a fish. And you know what? That was my home. And I couldn't get up in the morning to go to class. And my dream to be an English teacher, I could see that it was sliding. It was going, you know, south. There was nothing I could do about it. Because I just couldn't get it together. I'd sit up late at night and I'd pray. I remember even then praying once in a while to God, if you just help me get up tomorrow to get to that test, if you can just get me through this class, I promise I'll put it down. So from a very early age, I knew I had a problem with drinking. There was no denial in my life. It was really clear. When I drank, bad things happened. When I drank more than I wanted to. You know, and pretty soon a funny thing happened. My palms would start to sweat early in the morning in classes. And I couldn't figure out why I felt so nervous. But as soon as I had that drink, I was fine. And I was okay again. There was a sense of okayness that only a drink would bring. And later on, when my sponsor took me through the big book, I realized that I was drinking finally to overcome craving. I wasn't drinking because I wanted to. And from about 19 on, I drank because I had to. And that purposeful drinking is a different kind of drinking. It's the kind where we'll find any excuse in the world to have another drink. And I'll walk away from any situation, any job, any person. Doesn't matter. I walked away from having a relationship with my family, my brothers, anything to continue to drink purposefully. And when I was 19 years old, I was looking for a savior. And I saw a man dressed in a sweater, and I thought, that's it. It's him. He's going to help me. And I found the man of my dreams. You know, and he loved to ride motorcycles, and he just loved to drink like I did. And I thought we were a match made in heaven. And I thought that was going to be the beginning of a new life. I'd flunked out of college, and I wasn't about to tell him. And so we got back on that motorcycle, and we drove down the coast of California, get back down to Arizona. And that was the first geographical I ever really took other than school. And I remember the excitement of the life on the road and the drinking. And then there were so many times where it got so painful because I couldn't remember where I was. I'd end up somewhere and I'd see an arm across my stomach. And it wasn't his arm. It was someone else's. And those were the kind of nights that I woke up to. I'd start in Seattle and I'd end up in Houston, Dallas. And I couldn't figure out why. Such a nice girl, such a nice Irish Catholic girl that went to church and everything. And I was doing things that I never dreamed I'd do. I was being with people I'd never dreamed to invite to lunch, much less stay with. And those were the things that were happening to me over and over again. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And by the time I was 23, I finally reached out and I decided to go to a counselor. I figured they've got to help me. My mother was a psychiatrist, and I'd been analyzed up and down one side the other. And I knew that I had a lot of problems. She used to tell me. So I figured that was the best thing to do. So I went there, and they told me it was all my mother and dad's fault, that they were alcoholics, and I was just a product of a very sad childhood. And I was really relieved to hear that. So they gave me those funny pills. I think they were Librium or something like that. And I thought, well, that'll solve my problems. And that began to help me with the nervousness in the morning when I couldn't get a drink. But I continued on because, see, knowledge didn't help me any. That woman knew all about alcoholism. She knew everything about it, the progression. She knew about how one drink led to another. And she told me about it, but I couldn't hear it. It wasn't her experience, you know? And by the time I was 25 years old, I was living on the streets. I was scamming money. I was using a lot of other outside issues. And things were getting to a point where I had to use something else so that I didn't black out because I wouldn't give up the drink. And at 25, my boyfriend's brother, he was an alcoholic. Poor guy. Him and his wife just fought like cats and dogs, and even the kids didn't like him, nor the dog. And, you know, he had something had happened to him, very funny, because he stopped beating his wife. And he started bringing his kids to the park. And he started going to church on Sunday. And I thought, oh, gosh, he's gotten religion. Oh, no. And we didn't want to see him. Whenever we saw him come near us, we would want to leave. Because he had this message with him all the time. He kept whispering to me, Susie, there's a way out. There's a way out. And I was like, a way out of what? I thought I was living. I thought the alcoholic way was the only normal way to live. It seemed normal to me because at that point I was delusional. I really thought drinking and doing all those things was a part of life. Most of my day was consumed with getting drinks, getting more drinks, getting more money to get more drinks or outside issues and getting more drinks. And finding somewhere to stay. And sometimes it was a parked car. Sometimes it was a house where they were doing things that I didn't want to do, but it didn't matter to me. I just wanted to find somewhere to lay my head. And I didn't understand that there was a different way to live. And he kept telling me, Susie, you're worth saving. And that scared me. I didn't want to be saved. But really, in the deepest part of my soul, I did. And I could hear his voice sometimes late at night. And I'd be 200, 500 miles away from that man, and I could hear his voice after a bad night. There's a way out. And I went to a meeting one time with him. I finally broke down, and I went to a meeting. And there must have been, I don't know, probably 800 people in this huge, huge meeting. And they had a speaker, and he was phenomenal. I mean, he was funny. He was handsome. And I thought, now there's a man to be with. And I remember I identified just a small little bit. And I remember raising my hand when they said if there was any newcomers. And I thought maybe I was going to get a prize or something. But they didn't give me anything. They suggested that I get the big book. And I thought, well, why? You have them right here, you know. And then they said, if you want to stay sober, why don't you try going to a meeting every day like you were drinking every day? And I said, pardon me, but I'm busy during I couldn't come every day. I'm out street scamming. I couldn't do that, you know. That would really interrupt my schedule. I'm busy during, you know. Early evenings was good down at the mall getting money. So I couldn't possibly do that. And then they had the audacity to say I needed to stick with the women. And I was telling you, like, I don't do women. I don't like the boyfriend. I don't like them. They take your boyfriend, your money, or your clothes. So, you know, I wasn't going there. And, you know, they had great coffee, and sometimes women, those women, man, all they had to do, I guess all they did all day when you're sober is bake. I didn't know what they did. But they baked, and they made a lot of potlucks. So I would come to those meetings when things got really scary. When I, you know, in the morning when I couldn't face looking in the mirror, or when I needed a shower, or when I needed bus fare, I came and I took from you guys. Because that's what I thought I could do. That I could come in here and get refuge from the pain. Because I just wanted relief. I wasn't looking for freedom from alcohol yet. And it took 2 more years. You know, and the last night before I stopped drinking, something came upon my heart and it was deep in my chest. And there was a voice. I mean, where else can you hear voices and talk about it but in an AA meeting and they don't lock you up, you know? And this voice came upon me, and I knew it wasn't my voice. It was like an impression. Pick up the phone, Susie. Just pick up the phone. And I had an abscess on my arm. I weighed 89 pounds. My liver was swollen. I had sores on the roof of my mouth. I hadn't eaten in about I think 5 or 7 days is to the best they could tell. And I was in a drug house, and I was laying on the floor in sleeping bags, and I was drinking a bottle of Old English. Now that's a fine picture of a lady. That's what I had become. And it was as if I could see myself like an out-of-body experience laying on that floor in filthy, dirty sleeping bags. And I could see a pizza box around the corner, and I could see myself gripping that Old English for life. And I heard that voice again, pick up the phone. And back then, I picked the phone up and I pushed zero and the operator got on. It was a long time ago. And I said to that woman, as calmly as I could, I said, I think I'm going to die. I'm an alcoholic. And I need help. Bad. And I put the phone down and I started to yell through the trailer. We were living in an abandoned trailer with no running water. And I screamed down the hall, they're coming. And everyone started to leave. Of course, toilets were flushing, but there was no water. They were pretty upset. They were trying to get rid of things that shouldn't be there anyway. And they started running out of the door of the trailer. And nobody asked me if I wanted to come. And nobody sat with me. I sat there in the dark, waiting for the police to come. I was hoping they would come and put an end to what I had been doing. I wanted to die. But at the same moment, I wanted to live for the very first time in a lot of years. And I sat there, and they didn't come. And I wondered what was wrong, and I almost was going to call again, and the phone rang in. And oftentimes, if a phone rings into a drug house, it's not a good thing. And I picked up the phone, and a man said, my name is Ron. I'm with King County Detox. Is there anyone there that wants some help? Now, that woman had traced the phone and called King County Detox, and they called me. And I began to sob from the depths of my stomach that I didn't want to die. And he asked me if I could get on a bus. And I took the Old English. And I stood on the highway with a brown paper bag, and I'll never forget it. I had no money. I had sold my coat the night before at a gas station. I had 2 pairs of pants and a sweatshirt. And I put them in my backpack, and I stood on that road waiting for the bus. And when the bus came up, the bus driver just looked at me and shook his head. And he said, drink it in the back. And I drank that Old English for courage, my last drink. And that was September 28th. And they dropped me off a detox. And I looked out through the bars of the window. And I remember thinking, at last I'm safe. I'm safe. It's going to be okay. And that night they brought in a meeting to Alcoholics Anonymous into the detox. And as I was looking out the window, people were driving up in nice cars, and there were no dents. And people's clothes were clean, and their hair was fixed. And some of them even had umbrellas. It rains a lot in Seattle. And I just never seen people like that make an effort to come around people like me. I was really touched. And we sat down in a room, just a small little room, and a woman just sat there and she started to talk. And all of a sudden, it was as if she had followed me around for the last 15 years of my life. God had let her tell her story, which was my story, that she was not only powerless, but she had lost the God of her understanding, that she had not ever had a chance to really find a sense of hope or peace until she was broken. And that's it. That's what had happened to me. I finally was broken enough that I had needed and wanted God. And that's why I heard the voice. That's how I heard the voice. Back in 1985, when I went to the meetings and raised my hand, I didn't need God yet. I just wanted relief. But that day I knelt and I prayed, and she told me to kneel and put my shoes under the bed. And I did that night, and I said, dear God, take this obsession from me. Save me from myself. And that was my first prayer. And from that day on to today, I've not had to take a substance or a drink one day at a time. And that was really the beginning of my life. And that's the beginning of God's story. And I went to treatment when you're an indigent in the state of Washington, they had a wonderful program back then. They would give you 21 days of treatment, and it consisted of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and 3 meals a day. And there had a huge dormitory with 40 steel bunk beds. And I was delighted. Just recently, about 6 months ago, I found a gratitude list, one of the first that I ever wrote. And on the top of the list was 2 sheets, both clean. Socks that matched. I could eat 3 meals in one 24-hour period if I wanted it. That was the beginning of my recovery. That was the beginning of life. It took me weeks to be able to swallow because of the sores in my mouth. I was malnutritioned and my liver was really swollen. They weren't sure if I was going to make it. I was pretty sick. And at 21 days, it was time for me to leave. And I was terrified. I didn't know what to do. And I'd heard that there was a recovery center, a place that you could go, but you needed money. And of course, I didn't have any money. And I kept praying every day that somehow there'd be a way for me to get out there and start a new life. And somebody had put money up, one of those AA members, and had paid for my first month at a recovery center. And to this day, I don't know who did that for me. But I went into a recovery house, and I remember my first night at the outside meeting. I was on the way, and I was walking right in front of a Lutheran church, and I could see the sun just streaming through the window, and something told me to walk inside. And that was when they used to leave churches open. And I went inside, and there was a rose on the altar, and I knelt down, and I said to God, I said, God, if you'll watch me through this, I'll do your will. I surrender. And that was the beginning of me going to AA on a daily basis, because I've been taught if you drank every day, you should probably go to a meeting. I spent 6 hours drinking every night. Why couldn't I go to 1 hour of a meeting? And I went to my first home group, and I didn't know it at the time. It was going to be my home group. But the people there, they could see, they were door watchers. I don't know if you remember. But they could tell I was new. I had the deer in the headlights. I'm terrified, and I'm new. And they saw me from afar, and they brought me, a couple women brought me into a separate room. I didn't go into the meeting. And the lady asked me a couple of questions. She said, are you done for good and all? Have you had enough? And I said, yeah. And she said, are you willing to come to find a God? And I said, yeah. She said, and the third thing I'm going to ask, are you willing to go to any length for this program? Will you go to any length to stay sober? And I said, yes, ma'am, I will. And then she brought me into the open meeting. And that was my first experience with an outside meeting. And that woman later became my sponsor, and her name was Cheryl. And from a very, first couple of days sober, she had me kneel and pray to her God. I still hadn't come up with a conception of God yet, but I would believe that she believed, and that was how I started. And what was so wonderful about this woman is that she'd call the recovery house and she'd tell me to get my shoes on. And that was what it meant, was for me to stand on the porch and wait, because she was coming by to get me. You know, I had no transportation, just a bus pass that they issued us at the treatment center. And so she'd call, and I'd be standing on the porch with my shoes on, and I never knew where we were going to go. Some days we'd go and garden at another member's house. Other days we'd clean up. Other days we'd be at a meeting. Other days she'd take me to lunch. Heck, I didn't know what I was going to do, but this particular day, we went on a 12-step call, and that began to be the most wonderful part of my life. And me and this other young girl that were new, the car would pull up and she'd open the doors and smoke would just billow out. And Cheryl's sponsor, Ron, back then, you know, a lot of men sponsored women. And Ron and John was a big Indian man that was a sheriff. He'd come with us. And then the new girl and I and my sponsor, all 5 of us, would be smoking in the back of that car and we'd be heading on a 12-step call. And I tell you, those are the fondest memories that I have. And when we'd get to somebody's house, it was our job to, the young girl, Laura and I, we'd dump out all the alcohol. And you'd think that would be kind of a weird job for a newcomer. But it was a wonderful thing when my sponsor explained to me why she had me do that. She said, Susie, I want you to remember how you smelled. I don't want you to ever forget what you look like. I don't want you to ever forget the mess that you lived in. I don't want you to ever forget the pain that was on her face. I hope you always do this. And it was an honor to go and dump off the alcohol from that point on. And there were many nights that we would bring people to the hospital, and I would get to sit with them in the hospital all night long. And those are some of the fondest memories I have of getting sober. I had a wonderful home group, and it was a, you know, predominantly male home group. And, you know, the funny thing happened, you know, my sponsor, she kind of thought I dressed a little funny with the zebra print skirt and high heels. And I don't think she was real keen on it, but she was very kind to me. And, you know, one day I said to her, I said, you know, I don't look like these other ladies. And she said, I know, Susie, I know. And I said, I just want to be like you guys. I want to be a lady. How do you do that? And she said, well, Susie, you act like one. You just act like one. Pick a woman out that you respect and you think has the qualities you like and ask her how she does that. And then go with her and do the same thing. If she crosses her legs, you cross your legs. If she wears a shirt that covers her chest, you wear a shirt that covers your chest. If she says please and thank you, you say please and thank you. And that was a beginning for me. You know, someone told me that I'll never get my self-esteem back ever. You can't learn it in school and nobody can give it to you. But when you begin to do esteemable acts, something happens. When you begin to pray, something inside of your heart changes. And you begin to hear a voice that you never heard before. You begin to have a sense of direction that you didn't know was available to you. And there's something spiritual happening inside you, and you can almost feel the tingling. And I knew I was changing because I didn't want the zebra print skirt anymore. And the shoes went by the wayside. And I began to do things differently. And when I started to work my steps, I wrote my first step out longhand. And I remember thinking, three different states thought I had a problem with alcohol, and I ignored all three of them. I had documentable evidence that I was alcoholic, but I didn't want to hear it. It says in chapter 5 of How It Works, we're will nots. I would not live a rigorously honest life. I would not accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. I did not want to be one. And until I was broken, did I realize that the dilemma that I faced, being doomed to an alcoholic death, or accepting spiritual help, was a dilemma. I didn't even know that. I thought a dilemma was, you know, should I go to the mall or should I just shop in town? That's not a dilemma. A dilemma was two or more poor choices. And you see, when I first came to AA, either one of those choices was poor. I didn't want to shake a tambourine and shave my head and get all spiritual. I didn't want to do that, you know, because I wasn't done yet. I wasn't done. I was still looking for relief. And being doomed to an alcoholic death, well, you know, I was going to go out hard and fast before I was 30. But this changing that started to happen with the steps, I love in the foreword of the 12 and 12 where it talks about if you do this way of life and work these steps, it'll dispel the desire to drink. And what happened, not only for me, was the desire to drink at 68 days sober left me. It was miraculous. I did nothing to earn it. I did nothing to force it. I had stopped fighting and it was lifted from me just cleanly. And that's what happened. By 6 months sober, I was sponsoring other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was chairing meetings and we started to have, you know, I mean, just a life that I never dreamed of. We started to go on the road and visit other meetings and 12-step calls. And I mean, my life was full at 6 months sober. I had a permanent smile on my face. That night at Denny's, my stomach would hurt from laughing so hard. People would buy me ice cream, you know, and I was so proud. I was such an arrogant young girl, and I didn't want them buying me anything or giving me any cigarettes. And one day a man looked at me and he said, "You're the most arrogant homeless street person I'd ever met." And you know, that cut me to a quick. It knocked another chip off my shoulder. And you know what? There are days that I was able to start working, and I took 3 buses to a trophy shop in the morning to work, and I got to take off all the nameplates of the trophies and dust them. And that was my first job sober. And I was so glad to have a job. And then I'd take 2 buses at night to the meeting, and somebody from the home group would drive me home from Denny's afterwards. I thought that was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. People were there for me. People held coffee for me when I was shaken, when I couldn't hold my own coffee. People were at the door greeting me. People asked me genuinely, how was I doing? Was there anything I needed? You know, I got a lot more than I needed. You know, people were loving me in a way I had never been loved, something I had craved deeper than alcohol. And this funny thing that was going on, this reorganizing, something was changing in me. And when Wallace talked about the fifth step, I remember thinking that God had forgiven me. All I had to do was receive it. I had to put down my pride and realize I wasn't so bad, that there were people that had done a lot worse than I had, and they were good enough to be forgiven. What was making me stop letting me have a God? Why was I holding myself back? What was so special about me that he couldn't relieve me of the bondage of self? That third step prayer was the beginning of my freedom and the beginning of me coming to really believe. And I came and I came to believe. And then I came to know. When there was nothing left but God, he was there. And it was the most powerful thing I've ever experienced. And today I can call upon God in an instant. I was taught early on, this dress isn't the original dress, but my sponsor, she took me to a thrift store when I was newly sober and she bought me a dress. And I thought it was kind of morbid to buy me a sleeveless black dress, but I didn't say anything. And she said, we're going to funerals. You'll be going to many of them. You will walk over the bodies. And if you stay sober long enough, you'll speak in that dress. And that's why I wear this dress. It's very important to me. By the grace of God, I'm still here. And I think one of the greatest gifts of the steps has been the perseverance that I found from step 10. Early on, I was taught to do an inventory at night. And it's been the most critical thing for me. If you're anything like me, I have a tendency to forget about God. I kind of want to be God oftentimes. And my sponsor made this big, huge sign from my refrigerator. And it said, Dear Susie, I don't need your help today. Love God. And that was the most powerful thing for me, to be able to reflect on that on a daily basis, that God had never needed my help. It was me that needed his help. And the perseverance that Alcoholics Anonymous showed me, that just by living one day at a time, that life could add up, that you would have an opportunity to have a life you could never imagine possible by just doing good in one day. You know, the small things in a regular day, like my son, you know, I'm so blessed. I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 3 years sober. And I went to one of those funny AA dances that no one wants to go to, but we all go. And a man walked in from across the room. And I saw a little something in his eye, and I thought I better run the other direction, because that's what I've been told to do. As soon as I thought I should pick somebody, I better run the other way. But something happened, and we became friends. And I had never done that. I'd never been a friend with a man. I usually had a couple of questions like, do you live with your mama? And when they said no, I thought that was plus one. And then I asked, did they work? And when they said they had a job, that was two. We were getting close to dating. And number three, do you have a truck? And if they had those three things, then I ended up moving in. And it was now a relationship. And that's pretty much how I dated. Oftentimes late at night about last call. And that was kind of, you know, my requirements for a man, you know. But this man was different. You know, the funny thing is he did have a truck and he did have a job. But I didn't move in with him. And we started to date and talk late at night, and we actually went to restaurants to talk. Funniest thing. And he didn't come in my house. He didn't step over the threshold. He said goodnight to me at the door. I thought something was wrong with him personally. And then I wondered if I'd lost my attraction since I'd given up the zebra print skirt. But something was happening. I was connecting with this other person in a different way. He believed like I believed. He believed if we put Alcoholics Anonymous first, everything in our life would work out. And he believed that by coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could find a God of my understanding simply by working the steps. It is the result of these steps that the transformation occurred inside of me. and it continues to occur. You know, and I wanted a lot more in my life, and God has given me all that I could ever thought and more. I ended up marrying this man, and today we have a beautiful boy, 16 and a half years old, that he wants to go to UVA, and, you know, we just were up here a couple of weeks ago with him, and, you know, he's never had to see me drink or anything else, or my husband. And he understands about alcoholism. He was raised in meetings and going to potlucks. You know, he knows about 12-step calls. He understands when I have to go somewhere. He gets it. When I'm on the phone and he wants to ask me something, I have a sign. And I tell him like this. And this means this is really important. And he'll wait. Because he knows it could be a life on the other end that needs just a minute of my time. And that's an incredible life, to have a son that respects me like that and respects his program. You know, and this man that I ended up marrying, you know, he's a little bit younger. He's 20 years sober. And he's a real good guy because he's put up with me. And that 10th step that I was talking about, he does the same thing. And it's amazing when you live in a household where other people look at their behavior and when adults are willing to actually say that the words "I'm wrong" to a child. The child learns how to make amends for their behavior. And they begin to take responsibility. And I remember early on, I wanted that perseverance that my sponsor had. I wanted that willingness. 5, 6, 7 years into my sobriety, you know, we get a little comfortable. One of my friends in AA used to say, get a little money, a little sex, a little food, who needs AA, you know? And it's true, a lot of people, about 7 years into their sobriety, they kind of slide away from the program accidentally because life takes them out. And I could see that was beginning to happen. I had the home, the family, the son. You know, I kept praying to God, please, with that set-aside prayer, give me a new experience with this God, with these steps, with this book and you and my sponsor. And, you know, I started working the steps in a different way. And every year I've done a house clean. And every year, you know, through working the steps again, I found it a life of emotional sobriety, something that's way beyond the physical sobriety I was so grateful to have this first few months. But my life has taken on a life of its own. It's not my life anymore. When I wake up in the morning, you know, I ask for that perseverance today, that I can be willing to be interrupted, that I don't mind if someone calls when I'd rather go and do something else. I'll take that call. I ask God to give me the patience. If I need to be somewhere when I'd rather go buy shoes, that I go and maybe carry somebody to a treatment center. I ask God to never let me lose the vision of that trailer that night and day that I was living there, dying, hoping to God somehow somebody would help me. That vision I have to carry by helping other people, or I'll lose it. And the perseverance that I keep bringing up, I have to pray for the willingness to keep it. And I remember one day I was making my son a peanut butter sandwich. And I've made 1,000 peanut butter sandwiches now by this time. He was probably 10 years old. And I was smearing the peanut butter on there. And I'm thinking, oh, I'll just put it on a napkin and give it to him. And you know what? Something inside my stomach, all of a sudden I heard, how would you make me a sandwich if I was at your house? And it was God. And suddenly it occurred to me that I would take the peanut butter and I would take it to the very corners of the bread. And I would make sure it was an equal amount of peanut butter and that the jelly matched it perfectly. And when I put the bread together, I'd lay it on a nice plate and I'd cut it maybe in 4 squares and maybe even put some chips in the middle. And I'd hand it to God and I'd tell him, thank you. Now, why couldn't I do that for my son? And I started to do that. And that is the integrity of step 5. That's what that taught me. That no matter how small of an act, that might be the most important thing of that boy's day. That I was kind enough and I made a sandwich to the very, very best of my ability. And those are the kind of things that you guys have taught me to do in this program. That Alcoholics Anonymous is not just a program of attraction. It's a program that God shows us what we're capable of becoming. That we have an amazing gift here. That we get anointed to carry a message that no one else can carry. We transmit experience. We aren't given knowledge. We have experience that other people probably shake their heads in wonder. But when one alcoholic tells the truth to another alcoholic, there's some kind of spiritual magic that happens. And we know that they're being honest, and we know that they've been where we've been. And there is no better feeling than to be in the company of a woman that's walked in my shoes. And I know that that's a lifelong friendship. You know, I've come into the meetings and they taught me that the fellowship was my first substitute for a drink. And there were people in the rooms that I just felt kind of like a zingy attraction to. And I couldn't figure out why. I'm thinking, I'm even attracted to girls. Something must be wrong. And my sponsor, she described to me later on, she said, Susie, you're attracted to the spirit of light in others. Do you see the light in your eyes? And she brought me to a mirror one day. She said, can you see the light behind your pupils? I wish you had a picture of how you looked at detox that first day. And so I wrote the Cedar Hills Treatment Center where I went, and they sent me a picture of detox. It was the most powerful thing. I sobbed. My eyes were as black and as dark as death. And today I have light behind my eyes because of you. Because here is where God is. He's not at the Prestonwood Country Club. He's not hanging out, you know, up in Washington, D.C. with all the senators. He likes to hang out with people like me that make a whole lot of mistakes. And they don't really know what to do right, but are willing to ask. And that's been my experience. That when I finally tell people I don't know what the next right action is, somehow somebody else says something that's exactly what I need to hear. Somehow, one of you guys has the message that I've been looking for 2 weeks. It's an amazing, amazing phenomenon. You know, God has given me so much in my life. The internal transformation. I look at you guys. You know, we're lucky. Every day we come to a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, we get to see the hands of God. We get to see that. And other people out there, those earth people, you know, they might see God. Maybe once they see maybe a great aunt not die of cancer, or maybe once they get an opportunity, a quick glimpse of God, maybe at a sunset or a quiet moment with family. But you and I are different. If we want to, we see the evidence of God every day in each other's eyes. We're people that shouldn't be here. We're souls that shouldn't be here. It wasn't until I was broken could I realize how gracious God is, the kind of mercy that he would give us to let us live this life. You know, the path that I've lived on in the last 22 years, it's miraculous. Outside, I was talking to a gentleman, and we were saying how narrow the path has gotten over the years. And it's not because I've become narrow-minded. It's because the things that are important now, they're just a few small things that are important to me now. And they're my God, they're Alcoholics Anonymous, and my family, and my sponsor and sponsees. There's really not much that matters anymore. I don't think about the shoes. I don't think about the clothes. I've stopped collecting men. My husband's happy about that. I've stopped wondering if I'll ever grow up and be something or somebody. I am somebody. I'm a member in good standing. You know, I no longer do I worry if I'll get rich and famous. It's pretty clear I'm not going to be. And you know what? For a while, I wasn't happy with that because I still wanted more. And it seems like whenever I get in self-will, that's when I want more. When I'm in God's will, I don't want anything else. Today, the most painful thing for me is to be separated from God. And page 55 in the big book is one of the most powerful pages for me. It talks about pomp, calamity, and worship of other things. And those are the three things that have always separated me from God. And you know, as a child, I only wish I could have had a relationship with God. Today, you know, I started out my life 22 years ago on my knees. I still start my day on my knees. And I'm so grateful. And you know, I remember one time thinking, I'm still kneeling, I'm doing pretty good, I'm sober 22 years and I'm kneeling. And then all of a sudden I heard that voice again. And the voice said to me, don't be so proud of yourself, you can kneel. Do you know how many people can't kneel anymore that wish they could kneel before their Creator? That kind of stopped me cold. Those are the kind of messages I get. I can kneel, so I think I will. You know, that's the kind of life that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't get to get too smart around here. Somehow I get slapped upside of the head pretty quick. And you know what? That's the only way I've ever learned. That really is. You know, we're the hands and feet of God here. We can make the difference when other people can't. You know, early on, when I came into the meeting, they watched the door. So I was taught to watch the door. So if you come to my home group, it's called No Reservations, every Tuesday night, 6:45 in Cary, North Carolina. Call me up and you can come speak down there. We'd love to have somebody from out of town because that doesn't happen very often. But you can always come down to our home group. And, you know, our group is the kind of group where we wash the coffee cups out in the back kitchen of the church. And we get together and we laugh a lot. We have a lot of fun. But we go through the big book real slow. And I like it like that. Because anything too fast is usually not good for me. And I just like hearing the words because it rings true. There's something powerful about those pages and the black words written on those white pages. Not the words I like to add. You know, funny thing is those steps, the way they're written, they work exactly the way they're supposed to work. You know, and I don't have to come up with any fancy new way to do third step. I don't need to come up with any new fangled way of, you know, carrying the message. Everything that I have was brought to me from word of mouth and from that book, and it's still working. And I don't think anything else in my life is still working other than Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I've stayed married 18 years now, and that is a miracle, you know. And I pretty much attribute that to my husband. I don't take much credit for that one. And I really think that one of the best things about being married in Alcoholics Anonymous is it gives hope to the newcomer. There are so many people that come into this program, and I was one of them. I came in alone. I walked away from an 11-year relationship, and I thought that was it. That, you know what? I'll probably never find anybody. It'll just be me. And, you know, we can get on our pity pot. I did. And I remember finally letting go. It says in the book in 86 and 87 to stop struggling, to relax. Boy, oh boy, those are hard words for me. But when as soon as I relaxed the idea of getting some handsome man to take me out of here and, you know, get me a nice house on the hill and get me a fancy car, as soon as I got rid of that notion, something happened. I ended up going to that dumb AA dance, and I met my husband. But everything that I wanted, everything that I dreamed of, my God knows. And He knows before I know. And He prepares the path before I even believe He can prepare the path. He puts people in my life intricately. It's like a tapestry. The strings cross each other perfectly. It's like every person I meet, that mingling of those people are intricate to the way my life is going to be laid out. The people that I meet, the sponsees that I get to work with, my sponsor, the life work that I get to do working in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything is just prepared, and it's worked out for me, and I don't have to worry anymore. I spent a lot of my life worrying. I spent a lot of time, and I took a lot away from a lot of people living in fear. You know, today, there's not much that scares me except they were talking about those bears up on that mountain. I got a little nervous last night at the room. So I thought about putting the chest of drawers by the door, but I thought that may not even stop them. So, but, you know, life is not perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think that's another thing that we attribute. We think we get sober and suddenly just, woo, everything's going to be good. Handsome man, the car, the money, fancy stuff. Everybody's going to just jump up and down. Oh, Susie, I'm so glad you're sober. Well, that wasn't my experience. You know, my aunt, you know, the first time I saw her was 2 years sober. And I'd written amends letters to people in my family. And I finally did, you know, make amends to my mother. I worried my mother sick for years and years. She had no idea if I was even alive. I worried her to the point I would have probably drank too. You know, terribly hurt my family. And one day I went to my aunt's house, and I wanted to go up there and bring my little brother came up to visit Seattle, and I brought him to the door, and I got ready to leave because I didn't think I was welcome, and I was 2 years sober. And my aunt said to me, "I'm so glad to see you. Come on in." And then she ran up the stairs with her purse. And I thought to myself, I was so grateful that she asked me in her home, but she still couldn't trust me yet. But you know, that's all right. I never stole anything from her. I never planned on it. But she was afraid of people like me, and rightfully so. And it took her time to come around to trust me. And then when I was 5 years sober, she sent me an airplane ticket. And she picked me up at the airport for her son's wedding. And she handed me the keys to her car. And said, "There's a place for you to stay at my home." And if that isn't the product of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what is. That same woman that was terrified of me let me have the run of her home and her car. And those are the miracles of step 9 in this program. Some of the amends that I just have to talk about this one amends because it was just really powerful. I'm doing the trophy store and I'm doing really good and I'm saving money now for my amends. And we're on the envelope process. Back then, we'd have the food envelope, the rent envelope, the amends envelope, and the Susie envelope. And I liked the Susie envelope. And so every week I got paid at the trophy shop, and so I'd sit with my sponsor, because I wasn't good with money, as you could tell. I bought zebra print skirts and shoes with my money. If I had any money, if it wasn't drinking, I wanted to buy clothes. And so she didn't let me buy any clothes. And I thought that was a little mean, actually. But at the time, I learned how to do that. I learned how to pay back, and I started to make financial amends, $5 at a time. I owed a lot of doctor's offices, and I'm sure y'all know what that's about. And then I had a lot of debt. I think back in 87, I owed $7,500 cash. That's what I started my amends process with. I'd stolen from employers, and I had to pay back. And I thought that was crazy. You're going to pay an employer back for taking some stamps and some, you know, papers and stuff? Well, when I added it up, it was well over $150 that I'd stolen from past employers. So my sponsor made me send that money back to those employers. I thought that was a little rough. But wait till you hear this one. So I'm all excited because the Susie envelope's getting full. There's more money in the Susie envelope now. There's Brittany of $25. So I go to Kmart. Now, I don't call my sponsor. I just go to Kmart. It's Susie's day, you know? So I go to Kmart, and I'm walking around. I got that envelope, and it's eating me alive. Something has changed in me. I didn't even look at a dress or a pair of shoes. I thought about a TV. I wanted a TV for my room. And I'm walking up and down and pacing in front of the TVs. And all of a sudden, some little voice says, "Call your sponsor." I was like, "No, call your sponsor. She'll understand. It's a TV. It's not clothes." And finally, I heard, "Call your sponsor." And I did. And I said, "You know, Cheryl, I thought I'd just buy a little black and white TV for my room with my money." And she said, "Susie, you took money from people all across this country that you'll never, ever be able to pay back to. So we need to find a way for you to truly make amends to the people you can't find." And at that time, I thought, "Oh, she's going to make me send anonymous money out or something like Santa Claus?" And I realized that, no, that wasn't what was going to happen. I took money from people's children. I took money from their food, their grocery bill, because I was hitting people up in the parking lots, at grocery stores and malls. I interfered with people's financial security. I did a lot of damage. So I went to the Y the next week, and it was agreed upon that I would babysit at the Y for 3 months during the summer for free, and all the money would go back to the kids. And that was the most powerful amends I was ever able to do. Every day I babysat for kids from 8 until 5, and I knew that that money was going to be used to help those children. And that was a great thing. And no, my sponsor never did let me get the TV. It wasn't important. She said I could come watch hers. Now, I didn't agree, but eventually I did get a TV. But what she taught me was that it wasn't my money. It was God's money. And if I listened quietly and prayed about it, I'd hear where that money needed to go. And I heard where the money needed to go. One of the best things so far on this little trip that we've taken has been sitting in between Wallace and Tom. And I have to tell you, when I left my house in Cary, I was a little bit nervous. These two gentlemen, there's just so much life in both of them and so much principle and such a love for Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I've been in a protective mantle this weekend with these men. But I was a little nervous. I thought they, you know, they're just so good, you know? I mean, how do you sit next to somebody like that, you know? And then I thought to myself, I'm going to just bring God with me. And I'm just going to go and I'm just be myself and see how it goes. And as long as I got God, I'll be all right. And that's what's helped. Early in my sobriety, I was taught to bring God everywhere I went. You know, today when I do a fifth step with my sponsees, I set a chair out for God. I bring God everywhere. He's here. He was in the bathroom earlier when I was kneeling with the paper towel on the floor. He comes everywhere I go. I'm never without my God. You guys taught me how to do that. You know, there's a sense of peace and joy in having a relationship that you know can it will never end. It never has to go away. It's free and honest and true. And the greatest gift is we get to give that back to others. We get to see hope when there's no hope. We get to see love when there was only pain. And we get to see true freedom when there was definite signs of jail. I'm so blessed today to be sober, and I'm so grateful for the life that I've been given. I really think that if I had not called out that one time, I don't know where I would be. And I'm so grateful that at that moment I was willing to listen. Because the times before, God had been knocking for a long time in my life. You know, I had plenty of spiritual experiences. I've been hit by a car and thrown onto a sidewalk safely. You know, I had many experiences. And I mean that. I mean, I was like placed on a sidewalk. You know, so many miraculous things. I've driven drunk and went down a gully in between two trees and we wedged the car in between two trees. How many times does that happen? Time and time again, God has saved me from myself. Yeah, and I'm so blessed that, you know, I couldn't hear it, though. I just couldn't quite grasp that God could love me, that I was lovable, that I was worth something. I didn't want to hear it. You know, and finally, I think it was the steps that were the beginning of the true freedom of realizing that I deserved a loving God, that I could be who I am and not be afraid and let other people love me. And I could begin to love myself. And my sponsor used to say, doing those esteemable acts is what would change my life. You know, today I'm pretty involved in service. And it's always been important to me to work with other women. But I'm also a home group member. And I say this kind of, could stir some feathers up. But I think there's duties in a home group and then there's service. And I'm a coffee maker and that's a duty. That's just being a home group member. And I like that. I like making coffee and I like cleaning up and setting up chairs and washing coffee cups out. And I like being a part of. I came in here and these guys wouldn't let me do anything. I felt kind of silly, actually. But I like being a part of things today. I want to be in the mix. And before, you couldn't get me near the mix. And that's what you guys taught me. You welcomed me. You made me have a value, a sense of, you know, I could be just one among many finally. I didn't have to stand out. Didn't have to be special. I could just be with you. And that was really just an incredible idea. You know, and I think coming in here tonight, today, just seeing this room full of people and the beauty around here, I just understand that, you know, God has given me a chance to just open my heart and just stop for a minute and to realize that it's His transformation, not mine. These are His steps, not mine. This is His program, not mine. And this is His life, not